Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our captivating conversation with decorated Navy pilot Jim Lloyd, one of just 161 downed airmen recovered from behind enemy lines during the Vietnam War. He needed a series of miracles to survive his ordeal 50 years ago. Shot down, he made it to the ground in the dark with enemy all around, and when we left off, he'd been discovered by the enemy, a rifle pushed into his back as he lay face down on the ground. And you mentioned how awful that feeling was. Can you help describe that for us, what it felt like when they jabbed you in the back? It's more than physical pain you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it's emotional. It's a feeling of being caught and, you know, by the enemy. You know you're going to be in the mercy of the enemy. They could do whatever they want to you. I knew in that area that I was a little too far from Hanoi Hilton. I probably wouldn't survive. I wouldn't be around much longer. They'd probably just execute me right there. And so I just figured it was over with. I had nothing to lose. That's why I was able to roll over, you know, get the courage to roll over and face that gun and hopefully knock it to the side and see what happened. I had lost my .38, unfortunately, when I took off my survival vest. And as it turned out, that was probably a good thing because they would have hurt it. But at the moment there, I wish I had it. I remember thinking about that. And then I just, like I said, I just took off at it. I can't believe how fast I was able to run to get away from all that.
And one more question before we move on to the next element of this saga. You said as you're lying there face down in the mud, they're jabbing you in the back with a rifle. But you said something. You said that you prayed. And I'm always fascinated by this. And maybe you don't even remember what you prayed. But when guys describe a situation like this, I try to say, well, what would I pray in that moment? What does a guy pray when he's in that helpless and seemingly hopeless of a situation?
Well, obviously, I'm praying for something good to come out of it. In other words, not to get killed, not to be captured, whatever. And I'm an average person when it comes to religion, I certainly believe, but I'm not somebody that pushes my beliefs down other people's throats or any of that kind of stuff. But the old saying is there's no atheists in a foxhole is very true. Your situations that by then, I felt I was being looked after. I mean, there was no way that the decisions I made and the situations that happened would turn out in favor of me consistently like that, even up to this point. And it continued all night.
Yeah, and thank you for going there with me because that fascinates me. And maybe other people get a hint of this in their life where they end up against something that they have zero control over. And I mean, if there's ever a situation where you're not in control, even though all these decisions you made led to your survival, it sounds like that's where you were in that moment, that there's not much else you can do and you need some help beyond yourself.
There was absolutely nothing else to do but roll over or, you know, and it was maybe my prayers were answered and it gave me the courage to roll over. Maybe I wouldn't have done that. And, you know, years later, decades later, I think back of that. And I think, what if I didn't get the courage to do that? I just lay there. Of course, they'd all be right there and got me. You know, and here I had a slim chance. And somehow I had the ability to take advantage of it. So it was good fortune.
Yeah. So you go from face down in the dirt with bayonets in your back to escaping these guys. So now, but you're still not free. And you know that there's only a few hours of daylight left. So what happened next?
Well, I'd be going through these fields. I would say I'm wading through a rice paddy. It's 2 feet deep. And I'd hear off the distance, North Vietnamese. They'd be spread out and they'd be yelling, they'd be banging things. I thought I heard my name being called. I don't know if it was that or it was a Vietnamese word that sound like it, but I want to emphasize the human mind and body is absolutely phenomenal when it's pumped up like that with adrenaline and you're going through a life-threatening situation. I could hear everything. I could sense everything. And I'd see them coming and I'd hold my breath when they got close, duck down in that putrid water. I'd literally feel them walking by when I couldn't hold my breath anymore. They didn't know I was there. They were looking for me. When I couldn't hold my breath anymore, I'd slowly come up and I'd see them walking away from me. They went by me. Again, one of them could have stepped on me and found me, but that didn't fortunately happen. And then I would continue on. And I did that several times during the night. I started feeling then as, you know, I may get out of this. There's just too many things that are going my way just for it to end in failure. And I just want to mention the putrid water. The North Vietnamese fertilized those fields with human excrement for centuries. And basically, the analogy I use is I spent the night hiding in the basement of an outhouse. But it was the only cover I could find, and it's certainly the better of the alternatives. So anyway, after a few hours, I was really getting nervous. It was about daylight coming. It was about 2, 2:30 in the morning, and I got to a sort of a dry spot, and I pulled out my radio. I heard planes all night. They were flying all night. I called out on the radio, and I said, I think this is as good as it's going to get. It's kind of quiet here. You can go ahead and try to bring the helicopter in. I sat down. I remember slumping down, and my adrenaline started leaving me, and I literally ached from one end to the other. I was tired. I was worn out. Again, the adrenaline was a real shot in the arm, and I was losing it. The 2A7s that were over there flew 5 hours for me and refueled air-to-air, refueled several times to be there for me, and that's a long, long time for a single-seat aircraft that we flew. Now, an A6, the Truder, which is two people, the commanding officer of the squadron, Commander Ernst, and his Lieutenant Commander Grady Jackson, his bombardier navigator, took over command, unseen command, and they were overhead. And I remember saying, go ahead and bring them in. And one of them came back and said, Roger, Jim, it'll be 30 minutes. Just take it easy. And I thought, oh, take it easy. Well, one of three things is going to happen, and two weren't good. One was either in 30 minutes I'm going to be killed, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be captured, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be rescued. And I thought, wow, this is going to be exciting. And I just turned 27 6 days before, and I realized that, you know, there's a good possibility that in a half hour I might not get any older. So that, with adrenaline going, despair started to take over. And I want to just emphasize one thing that I learned. Despair is the worst thing that could ever happen to you. That's like, there's no hope. It's all over with. I can't help it. You know, you lose it. Fear, on the other hand, is one of your strongest allies. It hones your thinking, your instincts. You become an animal. As I mentioned, I'm so thankful that I was able to do that. And fear was one of my driving forces. And I found a big difference between the two. Well, despair was starting to hit in. I started to hear planes flying over. They were starting to stack up. They were getting ready to come in. And with the sound of the planes, the North Vietnamese would hear that, and they figured that's where I was, so they moved. I had found out when I'd called in that I found out later through air intelligence that I was exactly 2 miles from where I landed my parachute to where I was calling in for the helicopter at that point. I have no idea how many additional miles I made zigzagging to get there. But the fatigue was there. I mean, and so when they started stacking up, I started thinking, I don't know how I'm even going to see the helicopter. My helicopter training was in the daytime in the jungles. How was it going to work at nighttime in the open fields with the enemy all around? Well, my questions were answered pretty quickly. The A6 was leading in. He was bringing in the helicopter, and I want to mention there was three helicopters from HC-7 holding over the water, taking turns refueling and then holding for the call in. And when they get low, they come back and refuel. They were there for me, waiting all night long. The commanding officer of the helicopter squadron, Commander McCracken, went in and actually got to convince the admiral that he felt his people could do it, because there was a lot of doubt that they could actually pull a rescue off in that part of the country. And so he convinced them, and then he was one of the helicopter pilots. So anyway, they were orbiting back and forth, and Big Mother 60, flown by Lieutenants Harry Zinser and Bill Young, Doug Ankeny, and Matt Szymanski's were the two gunners in the back. They were ordered in, and they had their problems. They trying to take fuel while airborne off one of the destroyers, and they had trouble with that, so they left there with just a partial amount of fuel. And when they got to the beach, they almost flew into a row of trees until they turned the landing light on when they got nervous about it and avoided that. They flew over a village and got raked with small arms fire, where five rounds went right where one of the gunners, Doug Ankeny, was standing, and it missed them. Anyway, they came in, they're following the A6, and they said to me, Jim, take over vectors. So by then I could see the helicopter. He was lit up. He had everything, his landing light, everything on for me to see him. And they were just hosing him and down. I'd bring him in, and when he was right coming up to me, I was in his landing light. I stood up and gave my cover away, and he flew over. Unfortunately, he didn't see me. The planes overhead saw me, and the North Vietnamese saw me, but the helicopter didn't, and he disappeared. And I'm yelling on the radio, well, he was out of range for me to, when I was telling him to turn around. The planes overhead heard me and relayed it to him and told him to make a 180, turn back, which he did. Well, he comes in, and one of them says, show a light, any kind of light. Well, just then, pencil flares that we carried popped up all around. They got them from down airmen from previous shoot downs, and they were monitoring the radio. That confirmed it. And he said, which one's you? And I said, negative, none of them. Don't disregard. I'm turning my strobe on. Don't shoot, don't shoot, don't shoot. It was sewn on my right, on my left shoulder, and I wanted to do is take it off, turn it on, and throw it, say I'm 20 feet to the north or whatever, but there were, I couldn't get it off and off my shoulder, so I turned it on, and I didn't want it to be viewed by the gunners in the helicopter as small arms fire and be shot by friendly fire. Well, he went off to, he spotted me, and he went off about 100, 200 yards from me and went into a hover, and I just took off. Well, it sounded like I had the whole North Vietnamese army on behind me. I'd still lost my north, my night vision was gone because I was looking in that landing light. I couldn't see him, but I could hear him, and I just, as fast as I could run, he was in a hover. Of course, the noise now was deafening. Again, I didn't have a helmet on. I was getting beat up by mud and rocks, and I hooked on, we had a snap link on our torso harness that we hooked onto the cable, and I hooked on, closed my eyes and waited to be hauled up, and nothing. And I looked, and the helicopter was sitting right next to me in the mud. He had landed to get below a deflection angle of the AAA gun, a 37 millimeter that was right next to him, and he had to get below it before he was shot down. In fact, one of the A6s overhead later had said they saw that the guns going off and then the lights of the helicopter going out, and they thought they shot it down. Well, the North Vietnamese thought they shot it down too. And as I went to jump in the helicopter and with the weight of the cable on top of me, of course, I was completely worn out by then. And then he was holding power to keep being sunken, keep from sinking in the mud. So his struts were extended. So it was about neck high, the deck of the helicopter. And I went to jump in and knock myself out. Knock myself the wind out of me. Just then, the gunner looked there. The gunner was standing over me shooting. He stopped shooting, reaches over with his outstretched hand, and I could see his face in the dark. And he's saying, come on, come on. And that, I can say, that image I'll never, ever, ever forget. I could have been on the moon and not felt more any more further away from home. And here, there was this American pulling me in the helicopter. And he grabbed the back of my flight suit and pulled me in. In the meantime, since the helicopter landed, turned the lights off, as I mentioned, the North Vietnamese thought they shot it down. And so they were storming the other side, and Matt Szymanski held him off. He said years later, I was laying him down like cordwood. The helicopter took off. I remember it vibrating real bad from the strain of the engines and pulling off. And we had 21 long miles to go to the coast. And he was jinking. They were jinking to keep from being hit. And I didn't have any safety lanyard on like the gunners did. But I'd be jinking. I was afraid of being thrown out the open door. So I lay on the floor, afraid I'd be get shot to the floor. And I was going through shock again. And one of the gunners grabbed my arm, set me in a seat, strapped me in. Off we went. And right before we got to the coast, two fireballs went about 30, 40, 50 feet from us. They were the SA-7s, the relatively new at the time, shoulder-mounted heat seekers that they went after slow movers. We didn't have to worry about them in jets, but the transports and helicopters had to worry about them, and they just barely missed us. And then one of the gunners grabs my shoulder and points down, and I can see the breakers of the North Vietnamese coastline. We were feet wet. As I say, a savior of the naval aviator. And at least if we went down, the Navy would get us if we survived the crash. But we landed on the Cleveland. I didn't even know what kind of ship it was. Shut down, and that's when I met the crew the very first time, who became lifelong friends. And I got out of the helicopter. The commanding officer of the ship and his medical officer came up to shake my hand and jumped back. And like I said, I must have looked the sight, and I smelled a heck of a lot worse. And anyway, we found out we'd had 13 holes in the chopper. The sponson was shot off. There was a crease in the tail rotor, and they had way less than 5 minutes of fuel, which is nothing. I mean, those gauges aren't even accurate for probably 10 minutes of fuel, plus or minus. So that was another miracle. And I cleaned up and I debriefed. It was probably now about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Got a bite to eat. And then they flew me to my ship. And I debriefed there. The admiral had me for dinner, wanted to hear all about it. I debriefed him and his staff. They flew me to the Philippines. And I debriefed about 4 or 5 different staffs there before coming back. And everybody kept saying, well, son, you're going home after what you went through. Well, I'd seen it, done it all. I was ready to go home. And then I came back in the right seat of an A-6. Way off the distance, I heard the plane call of somebody calling for his wingman or flight leader that was shot down. Beeper, beeper, come up voice. That's the call, looking for somebody. And I realized that I can't go home. Sorry. I got more flight gear and flew for another 5.5 months. They did a good job of giving me a little easier flights, but I had some exciting times before the cruise was over with, and then came home when everybody else did. And the end of January 1963, flew for had a month off, and then transitioned to the newer A-7 and got out of the Navy, my original schedule, in July of 73.
And I have to ask the question, you know, why? You gave us a taste of it. But why was that so important to you to stay there another 5.5 months, knowing that, I mean, you've just lived through, I don't know how many threats to your life on that one night. You know that you're putting yourself in harm's way when you don't need to. I mean, you had the golden ticket home and you turned it down. Why?
Well, first of all, I didn't know it'd be 5.5 months. You know, we were on an open-ended cruise. In other words, they say, well, it's October, we're going home. And then it wouldn't work out. Thanksgiving, we'll be home. No. Christmas, no. You know, so it wasn't like I knew there was 5.5 months as it turned out, but it probably wouldn't have made a difference anyway. I had learned what the Navy did for me. Our aircraft carrier, our air wing, was supposed to go out of flight ops right before midnight when I got back on my flight. They stayed in the wind and did double duty all night long, flying, launching and recovering aircraft. Our captain was Captain Sanderson, and years later, as a vice admiral, he had told a friend of mine he had 51 airplanes in the air at one time. And I don't know if that's our carrier and the Midway, who were flying all night for me as well, or just our ship. But they were there for me all night long. When I heard that plaintive call of a guy going down off one of the other carriers, I thought, where am I going to be if they need me? Fat, dumb, and happy at home. And I said, I could not live with myself that way. And so, yeah, it wasn't always easy, but it was the best decision I ever made in my life. One of the most difficult, but one of the best, because I could look back and feel good about myself.
Quite a story, isn't it? And we're not done yet with Jim Lloyd. You're hearing his voice, but it's possible you've seen his face a time or two in movies and television. We'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.